This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah. وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: a Taliban spokesperson says that the group would have no discrimination against any ethnic group in Afghanistan. A convoy belonging to Iraq's popular mobilization forces reportedly comes under airstrikes near the Iraq-Syria border. And South Korea says its neighboring North has fired two ballistic missiles into the sea days after Pyongyang announced it successfully tested a new long-range cruise missile. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumisha Ahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. A senior Taliban spokesperson says the group will refrain from a policy of isolationism and make efforts to engage with the world.
If we marginalize ourselves, that is not in our interest. Why we should marginalize? Will we engage with the world and then ourselves marginalize us? What is the benefit of that? It is better for us. It is the interest, our national interest, and in the interest of our country and people to have engaged with the world and the international community and to have cooperation with
us. Sohail Shaheen said the group is now focused on rebuilding Afghanistan, adding that to do so, the Taliban counts on international aid. The spokesman noted that there is no war currently going on in Panjshir Valley, where there was a resistance against the group. He stressed that the Taliban preferred to resolve the issue of Panjshir through talks, but had no choice but to resort to military operation when negotiations failed. Shaheen also rejected the allegations that the Taliban received assistance from Pakistan in their fight in Panjshir. On the issue of the caretaker government, a spokesperson said the group stands by its commitment to form an inclusive government.
We need such a cabinet because there was urgency, there was vacuum, and people needed some essential services. So an urgent, this cabinet was made on urgency basis, but at the same time, we believe in inclusiveness. There should be from every ethnicity people to see themselves in government.
Now, Shaheen further said that the group would have no discrimination against any ethnic group in Afghanistan. He stated that the Taliban respect women's rights within Islamic law, adding that they have the right to education and work. The Taliban official also noted that the group no longer sees itself as fighters, but rather servants of the people. EU leaders must end foreign interference following their disastrous involvement in the destruction of Afghanistan. That appeared to be the key message of emerging from a debate in the European Parliament. Our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, reports.
EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell has posed a series of questions to EU legislators in the light of the Afghanistan catastrophe. He asked, what does it mean for our relations with the US? And then he went on.
What does it mean for the development of European strategic autonomy, for our security, and for our defense policy?
During the two-hour European Parliament debate, at least a dozen lawmakers told Borrell the last thing the EU needs is more military spending.
The lessons to be learned. We have to end universal interventionism that has only led to disasters in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan.
Apparently, the West demonstrated enormous arrogance in Afghanistan.
In overshooting self-confidence, instead of helping nation building, we try to impose nation building.
The US-led invasion of Afghanistan resulted in a countless number of civilian deaths and also life-changing injuries. We have visited a center for asylum seekers in Brussels. As they wait for help, people here feel let down by EU and Belgian authorities.
They don't care about women, they don't care about children. Why they do like this? What's the difference between Afghanistan and Belgium?
The plight of Afghan refugees was also talked about at length during the European Parliament debate.
The selfishness of many European authorities and political parties that showed no solidarity towards those refugees that left the country.
The reason given for going into the country to defeat terrorism was rubbished.
You are killing innocent people, women and children. You are creating terrorists, fighting migration. You are destroying the place. You are creating migrants.
The European Economic and Social Committee has published a statement pleading with EU leaders to cooperate in a meaningful way with key countries surrounding Afghanistan, including Iran, Pakistan, China, India, and Russia, in order to achieve the stabilization of Central Asia. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Moving on, a convoy belonging to Iraq's popular mobilization forces has reportedly been hit by airstrikes near the Iraq-Syria border. Media reports show that the attack took place near the town of Al-Bukamal in Syria's eastern province of Deir ez-Zor. Three vehicles carrying infrared monitoring equipment were reportedly targeted during the airstrikes. The monitoring equipment is used to prevent infiltration by Daesh terrorists. Some reports indicate that the attack was carried out by the United States. The U.S. military, however, denies any involvement. Back in February, the Pentagon conducted airstrikes against resistance forces in the same area. The Palestinian Authority has confirmed that almost 1,400 prisoners in jail, in Israeli jail status, are set to go on an open-ended hunger strike and protest at their detention conditions. The head of the Palestinian Authority's Commission for the Prisoners says the inmates are going on a hunger strike as the situation in the jails is very bad. He noted that prisoners will start the strike action on Friday and will be joined by other inmates next week. The prisoners say they want the Israeli regime to end its policy of repression and abuse against inmates. Earlier on Tuesday, a group of Palestinian people also went on labor strike in occupied Al-Quds in solidarity with those prisoners. They slammed Israel's treatment of Palestinian inmates and called on the international community to take action. Local commentator Bruce Katz says the awful conditions in which Palestinian inmates in Israeli prisons find themselves are absolutely brutal and inhuman.
The awful conditions in which Palestinian prisoners, who for the very most part are political prisoners, the conditions in which they find themselves, which are absolutely brutal and inhuman. At the very heart, the Israeli prison system is at the very heart of its apartheid colonial institutions, and it's extremely brutal regime, which, as far as I'm concerned, is steeped in criminality. And the way that they try to get around it is to use the bugbear of anti-Semitism by accusing anyone who dares to criticize this terrible apartheid system as being anti-Semitic, when in effect the real racists are in Tel Aviv, sitting in the Knesset, running a corrupt government that attempts to crush the life out of Palestinians and Bedouin on a daily basis. So there's no surprise that the prisoners are going to go on a hunger strike once again.
Moving on, South Korea's military says the North has fired two ballistic missiles into the sea days after it tested a new long-range cruise missile. Seoul's Joint Chiefs of Staff says unidentified ballistic missiles have been fired from the North Central Inland Area to the sea off the East Coast. South Korea has called for a National Security Council meeting over the missile launch. It comes as Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi has visited Seoul for talks with his South Korean counterpart. Chung Il-young pledged that he would continue fostering peace with the North, urging China's support. Meanwhile, Japan has denounced North Korea's ballistic missile launch as outrageous. Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga described the move as a threat to peace and security in the region. Also, Frank Smith says that the United States is standing firm with its hard-line positions towards North Korea and is not going to offer any incentive to that country.
You know, the meeting between Chung Il-young and Wang Yi today sought to cast light on the differences in policy toward North Korea. China and South Korea are sort of on the same mind. They feel that there needs to be United Nations Security Council sanctions relief for North Korea in order to encourage to get them to come to the negotiating table on denuclearization talks. The U.S. is so far standing firm with a hardline position that it's not going to offer North Korea any incentives, but is willing to negotiate what it calls unconditionally. And we also have news today that North Korea has fired a projectile that landed in the waters off of the east coast of South Korea just earlier today. This indicates that North Korea is not going to wait for the United States to come out to negotiations, any type of unconditional negotiations, that it's going to continue to develop its military deterrent and continue with business as usual until there's some type of incentive from Washington.
Chinese President Xi Jinping has reportedly turned down an offer by his American counterpart Joe Biden for a face-to-face summit. According to the Financial Times, the Chinese president suggested that the tone and atmosphere of bilateral ties need to improve first. The White House and Biden himself have denied the account. The two leaders spoke on the phone last week for the first time in 7 months. Washington and Beijing have been at odds over a host of issues, including the South China Sea, as well as developments in Hong Kong and Taiwan. Beijing has maintained that the U.S. policy towards China has long been a bone of contention in bilateral relations. The U.S. Justice Department restricts the use of chokeholds in federal law enforcement agents and warrants for their unannounced entries into premises. Attorney General Merrick Garland announced the curbs as a confidence-building measure aimed at improving law enforcement safety and accountability. The use of chokeholds and so-called no-knock entries were at the core of several highly controversial cases of police killing targeting African Americans. Among them was the 2014 death of Eric Garner in New York and that of George Floyd, who died in May 2020 after a Minneapolis officer knelt on his neck for several minutes. In March 2020, Breonna Taylor was killed in a botched police raid on her apartment in Louisville, Kentucky. Focal commentator Annette Freeman says that what black and ethnic communities need in the U.S. is decolonization and a shift in power rather than a change in arrest tactics.
I mean, the initial problem is that we're the African people and indigenous people in this settler colony are colonized people, and that the police are there to enforce this colonization. That means criminalizing behavior and things that should not really be criminal, that are, you know, subject to the laws of settler colonialism. If we look at even the cases, and besides aside from the tactics or whatever used by these officers, most of these cases are people that shouldn't, why were they even being stopped in the first place? I mean, and so if we even deal with that, just that, you know, just speaking to the criminalization of our very existence, our survival, which is what this the state is not willing to do. So the only solution to that is decolonization on the local level when it comes to the front line, the extension of the state, which is the police that are there to enforce this paradigm. Then the first solution is community control over the police. So it's not about, you know, civil suits or qualified immunity or anything. It's about decolonization, and it's about us having control. A power shift must happen, and that power shift must be things that put this power over these things into the hands of the communities and the people most impacted by these obscenities.
Now, three former U.S. intelligence agents have admitted to taking part in a hacking scheme to help the United Arab Emirates spy on its enemies. The three men worked as online spies for a company linked to the UAE government. Prosecutors say the trio broke into U.S. computer networks and sold sophisticated hacking technology to the Arab country without permission. According to the U.S. Justice Department, those hacking and intelligence gathering systems were used to sneak into computers in the U.S. and other countries. To resolve criminal charges, the defendants agreed to pay nearly $1.7 million in penalties. That is the money that they earned while carrying out the hijacking job for the UAE. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez travels to Barcelona for the resumption of talks with regional leaders on Catalonia's independence bid. Sanchez has confirmed that he will meet Catalan leader on the region's political situation. Initial talks began in February 2020, but were soon suspended after the coronavirus pandemic. Now the new round of negotiations begin amid radical differences between the two sides. The Catalan separatists have two key demands. They want an amnesty for all those involved in the 2017 failed independence bid and a new referendum on self-determination, this time with Madrid's approval. Madrid is firmly against both. Now, with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Supplication on Wednesdays.
worshipping the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick, and healed, and made well, and afflicted, and sat upon the throne, and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The limelight.
A drone strike last month in the last days of the U.S. occupation follows the same logic that 20 years ago turned 9/11 from a day of tragedy and violence into two decades of tragedy and violence, says Sam Carliner Ryder in an article titled Never Forget Victims of U.S. Drone Program. Stay tuned for more. As the mainstream press spent this past week once again ensuring that Americans never forget the fear and anger of 9/11, which prompted 20 years of war, 10 of the latest victims of 9/11 were being wiped from historical memory. Just 2 weeks before the 20th anniversary of 9/11, a U.S. drone killed the Ahmadi family, including 7 children. In the U.S.-centric writing of history, they have already been forgotten. The U.S. military surveilled 43-year-old Zamari Ahmadi throughout his final day. He went about his normal routine as a Kabul-based employee of the aid group Nutrition and Education International. Ahmadi dropped off his co-workers at various locations throughout Kabul, filled water cartons at his office, and drove home to a residential compound where he lived with his family and his brother's family. As his own children and his brother's children ran to greet him, a U.S. Air Force Reaper drone launched a missile at his car, re-incinerating him, and the 9 loved ones gathered around him. For those who have been paying attention, it is not surprising that Biden's drone strike killed a family, and it will not be surprising if additional bombing of Afghanistan kills more civilians. This is the very nature of the drone program, which became a norm of U.S. policy under the Obama administration. This is the story that the New York Times uncovered through extensive interviews with Ahmadi's neighbors, colleagues, and medical experts. The Washington Post did its own extensive reporting and reached the same conclusion of the events. The story that U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair General Mark Milley gave to the public to justify the strike is very different. Milley claimed that the attack was a righteous strike against ISIS-K members. U.S. military fed the lie to reporters that there was a second blast following the drone strike, proving that Ahmadi had explosives in his car, which he was planning on using to launch a second terrorist attack on Kabul airport. Those explosives were in fact the water cartons Ahmadi was bringing to his family. The New York Times and Washington Post both found that there was no second blast, just the one directed by the U.S. military that incinerated 7 kids. Responding to the Times reporting on Twitter, Matthew Hogue, a disabled combat veteran and anti-war activist, put it best. This very well sums up the last 20 years. Fear, barbarism, ineptitude, and lying. This drone strike follows the same logic that 20 years ago turned 9/11 from a day of tragedy and violence into 2 decades of tragedy and violence. What was never correct was the idea pushed by the politicians in the highest positions of power and media outlets with the largest platforms that in exchange for these 2,996 lives, hundreds of thousands more needed to be taken. It was incorrect, but it was possible because the U.S. lives taken on 9/11 were made out to be more valuable than the lives of Afghans or Iraqis. 20 years later, U.S. troops were finally leaving Afghanistan for good. An attack on Kabul airport killed 13 U.S. troops. 170 Afghans were also killed by the attack, as well as shooting by U.S. forces in the immediate aftermath. However, much like on 9/11, it's the smaller number of American lives lost that are significant to the corporate press and politicians. It is because the lives of these 13 American troops matter more to certain sections of the American public than Biden vowed revenge. In exchange for the lives of these 13 troops, 10 Afghan civilians, including 7 children, were easy targets for retribution. Then U.S. government lied about these victims, claiming they were terrorists. U.S. troops may no longer be occupying Afghanistan, but if the devaluing of Afghan lives, the violence of the U.S. war machine, and the lies from U.S. leaders continue, it could only be a matter of time before they are dragged back into war again. Biden has already made clear his commitment to keep bombing Afghanistan. For those who have been paying attention, it is not surprising that Biden's drone strike killed a family, and it will not be surprising if additional bombing of Afghanistan kills more civilians. This is the very nature of the drone program, which became a norm of U.S. policy under the Obama administration. From January 2012 to February 2013, the U.S. terrorized Afghanistan with Operation Haymaker, a military campaign of drone warfare in which 90% of victims were not the intended targets. No one from the Obama administration has faced any consequences for the terror of the drone program, nor have any members of the Trump administration faced consequences for waiving rules of engagement for airstrikes in Afghanistan, resulting in a spike in civilian casualties. Daniel Hale, however, was sentenced to 4 years in prison for having the courage to provide the public with information about the drone program and its disregard for civilians. If voices like his were not silenced behind bars, maybe there would be more public outrage, or at least public acknowledgement of the civilian toll of U.S. bombs and drones. The war in Afghanistan is not over until the drone program has been shut down. The Afghan people have been paid reparations with money taken directly out of the Pentagon's budget, and prison cells have sought out whistleblowers for war criminals. Along with this full ending of the war, the United States will need a reckoning with the militaristic culture, which made war on Afghanistan at first a popular demand and later a background noise that most Americans could ignore. That militaristic culture is still packed into American entertainment and news commentary, simmering until the next reason for war allows it to boil into another frenzy of xenophobic vengeance. This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Muslims in America.
It is the year of hate, broken glass, graffiti, and threats. It is also the year in which rhetoric reaches paroxysms of horror. This is when a whole nation witnesses and perhaps helps keep silent about what can only be described as a regime of oligarchic fascism. This is the worst year to be Muslim, Hispanic, or African American in the United States.
The state of Florida is outlawing the sanctuary cities.
Kahuram addresses the crowd at a social justice event. His words serve as a reminder of what used to be known as the American dream. This attorney came to the United States with less than $10 in his pocket. And today, he is one of the key defenders of the rights of citizens in the state of Florida. However, that fight is at risk.
The Muslim community is very concerned, and I would say very fearful, because this is the first time that in a very open and notorious way the government is coming after them. But at the same time, they are buoyed by the fact that there are others standing with them this time. And so that is giving them some strength to come out to rallies like this, to come out and speak out more.
Early months of 2017, Donald Trump becomes the 45th president of the United States. His agenda is far from solving the real problems of the country. It is to confront ethnic and religious minorities in the first place.
I was pretty shocked when I found out about it, and I didn't know how to react to it because, I guess, hearing stories that have already happened in the States, I kind of would have reacted stronger if, you know, like, there's been a lot of incidents where Muslim students have been spied on. So I wasn't as shocked as some other people were, but I was really worried because why? Why would they spy on students? I mean, we're only students, and not only do we have the freedom to speech, but also what could we be saying that can threaten anyone, you know? Like, what could we be saying that could be so important for people across the country to know and hear? We're just students, regular students like everyone else in any other school, in any other part of the world.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here today to unveil.
And so the first stop in the Trump administration, travel ban on the citizens of 7 Muslim countries, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Sudan, Yemen, and Somalia. And although after appeals from district courts, the move was blocked and Iraq was eliminated from the infamous list, Trump and his collaborators proceeded with the litigation, reaching the Supreme Court, where an alternative version was approved, but equally harmful to hundreds of thousands of people and families. So as the current administration keeps going, it is no longer surprising that some sectors of society have legitimated Trump's xenophobic discourse. As a result, the deep social damage has been done through dehumanizing ethnic and religious minorities.
So it's disappointing to see that the U.S. Close in on itself the way it is right now. But I also understand that it's really up to us, and we are the ones who can change it. Well, you know, I was a Muslim after 9/11, and it was a pretty rough ride then as well. And quite frankly, at least this time we have allies. I have all these folks here who understand that the Muslim community is being targeted. Immediately after 9/11, we didn't have that. We had no allies.
You know, it's okay to say that Muslims are terrorists.
Right.
It's okay to say that immigrants are criminals. So how do you feel about that? Because it's going to change forever?
No, I don't think it's going to change forever because, look, the truth is that I really do believe that the government is us. And if we turn up the volume loud enough on our message, that will change the message in Congress, and that will change the laws. The president doesn't make the laws. Congress makes the laws. So if we really want to see this type of community that you see here become the norm. So while things are difficult, the one only positive thing I can say is that this time, as Muslim, I'm not in it alone. I'm in it together with others, and these brothers and sisters really understand that this is about America. This is about whether or not this country will still be what we want it to be tomorrow.
It was an ordinary morning like any other. People were going to their offices or had already begun their daily work. On the horizon appeared gigantic metallic eagles with an innocent human cargo and tanks full of fuel. Two towers fell, and a Pentagon. Thousands of deaths. And so, the world was never the same again. The attacks were followed by thousands of exclusions, attacks, denunciations, and wars. A demon was born, which in turn gave life to another demon. And whoever was the mastermind behind the massacre, the innocent people paid for the sinners. The world was never like this. Yusuf is an academic who has dedicated himself to his doctorate in Islamic studies and the Middle East. But before going to college, Yusuf was in the U.S. military. Today, it's not surprising if a month passes without a visit from agents of the Federal Intelligence Services. The mere fact of being Muslim is an alarm or a stigma that follows you everywhere. Yusuf is not alone. Some say that every Islamic center, mosque, or Muslim group is under constant surveillance. Even newspaper reports from the Washington Post acknowledge the existence of national databases with the identities and personal details of Muslim citizens and residents in the United States. According to the federal government, this is a matter of national security. But others, like these students who found a spy microphone in the Muslim Student Center of Florida International University, believe that this scrutiny is undue and unnecessary.
I know that there has been a history of spying on Muslims in college and university settings here in the United States, but it was a surprise to me because I didn't think it would actually happen to me and my community. American International Relations, or American Islamic Relations, we contacted them and asked them their opinion on what we should do in terms of Muslims in college and university settings here in the United States. But it was a surprise to me because I was of this finding that we found here. And in my opinion, there's a certain way the media is portrayed in America.
I know, I mean, especially since the events that happened after 9/11, you know, we're under a lot of scrutiny. And of course, if something like this happened, right, in the Jewish or Christian club, you know, personally, I would think that
this would be in the mainstream media.
It would be in an instant, you know, and a lot more action would be taken in a shorter amount of time. So we have, as Muslims, we have it harder on us in order to, you know, bring this awareness to the public. But we have to do what we have to do. We can't just sit around and, you know, let this happen to us.
But in any case, it is worth asking, what has changed since September 2001? To analyze this, it is necessary to see the evolution of the official discourse towards the common citizen, as well as the strategies mapped out to influence public opinion. For the first part, the federal monitoring activities were intended to penetrate the social frames of the Muslim community. The information derived from these activities made it possible to establish patterns of behavior as well as sociocultural superstructure. Once this process has been carried out, with the data obtained, it is possible to create media campaigns for social control. Time is passing by. It is 2017. The semantic superstructure of the message is already out there. The stereotype of the Muslim citizen as an entity different from the Western citizen and unfamiliar with Western culture. The relationship between terrorism, insurgency, and extremism has been established in relation to an ethnically and religiously different community.
When I want to talk to you, if I come with the rude face, would you like to talk to me? Never. Always you go with the positive. So Allah always says in the Quran, if somebody did wrong, better way you can forgive. This is the teaching. Yeah, if you have the courage to take the revenge, if you forgive, you will get the reward and reward and reward from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this is the teaching of Islam. So how you can say Muslim is going to, it means some people is making against the Muslim, it means they are not a Muslim. So they keep the name as a, like my name is Naseem. So if I am going against by myself, so what makes my name is different? Name is nothing. What you have inside.
Some believe that these stereotypes are no longer exclusive to the federal agencies involved in the subject. They are shared by the media, social groups, and unfortunately, political leaders.
In 1 month, we see like 11 attacks against Islamic centers. And this came due to the fact that the patching and attacks and from the candidates. Some candidates, they are causing and inflaming the public against Muslims. They are breaking the communities. I don't know what kind of candidate running for the seats to a country that instead of building the country and make it stronger and to bring people together, they are dividing us. And they, by attacking groups, whatever the group are, we're all against terrorism, we're all against evil and wrongdoing, but we should unite instead of attacking each other.
In one of its most recent reports, the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, asserts that the states of Washington, California, Florida, Virginia, New Jersey, New York, and Michigan have seen the most widespread acts of vandalism against mosques or Islamic centers. On average, each of these states has been the scene of 11 or more attacks against these establishments.
I feel like that's just an excellent way for them to propagate their twisted ideological belief system, which perpetuates violence and keeps perpetuating the stereotype to keep hatred. You know, as long as you can keep the people hating, then nothing has to change. You don't have to change the stat quo. If you have to change the stat quo, then people lose money. Money is economic. It's about economics. And then I feel like, you know, sometimes I feel sad for people who don't know what's going on. You know, like if they really believe that they're right and they're wrong, they're so ignorant, so ignorant.
But not only violence is active and manifest, it's also visible at other levels. The institutionalization of Islamophobia in educational entities, government calendars, etc., is a case in point.
I have two grown kids. One, like, you know, he's on 23 now, and one is 14. When they were in high school, they keep asking me. Everybody have like a holiday, like a Christian people have like a Christmas, and Jewish people have a Sabbath. So what you can have like this?
Yeah, what do you say to
them? I said, well, time gonna come out, we'll see. This time they're gonna approve it in this district.
Precisely for this reason, people like Abdul Rashid believe that the Muslim community in the United States has a status of second-class citizenship. The stigma of the stereotypes prevails, and the competition conditions are unfavorable, only due to the religious and cultural backgrounds. The situation Abdul Rashid described is similar to the experience of this father.
We are all U.S. citizens, born and raised here. And that's why we're here, because we feel like we don't have no voice, and we're Americans. If, may God forbid, this happened to Tariq, to any other person, like a Jewish boy, you know, the reaction will be different from U.S. representatives, and that's really what's frustrating, and that's why we're out here saying that please be equal. We don't want no loss of life. Even the three teenagers that the Jewish boys that were lost, you know, we're all parents here, we're all moms and dads. Nobody wants a loss of life. But at the same time, this collective punishment that's going on against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and in West Bank and now in Shafah.
Ismail speaks three languages, namely Urdu, English, and Spanish. He is concerned about how lies are being spread about Islam and its followers. Meanwhile, for this student, what was once only fear has now become a reality. Hijab, part of women's dress in Islam, has become problematic wherever she has to go to school, work, or shopping.
So they would ask questions and make comments, but the fact that I have to face that with my family as well, because I converted into Islam, it's very worrisome. So it's not only with people I don't know, with strangers, it's also with my family. The House of Representatives, which is the first part of Congress, they're the very first ones to look at these bills that are being considered into becoming laws.
The majority of Muslim nations in the world own the richest hydrocarbon reserves on the planet. Yet after more than a century of bombings, revolutions, and violence, they are looking for a better future, or at least a way to save their lives. Therefore, the exodus of Muslims continues to countries such as the United States. It is not an invasion, as President Donald Trump assures. On the contrary, It is an obvious consequence of failed foreign policies and closed-door interests.
And no one in the U.S. is entirely clear on why the war in Afghanistan happened, but we know the reality is that it's a matter of geostrategic domination. It's a matter of profits. But this war has killed, you know, killed millions of people, and both of the politicians, they're continuing on. But every survey taken of the U.S. population, every single one that I've seen, the last numbers I saw were like 66% of the people in the U.S. want an end to the war in Afghanistan. They want an immediate end. But that's not on the agenda of the politicians. You know, what the politicians proposing that we stay for this long, we stay for that long. You know, the politicians are proposing, you know, they're putting sanctions on Iran. They want war with Iran. No one in the U.S. wants war with Iran, except for the bourgeoisie, except for the politicians. So, you know, our campaign, like I said, is calling for an immediate end to the war in Afghanistan, an immediate end to the sanctions against Iran, an immediate end to the billions of dollars given to Israel to oppress the Palestinians. And, you know, we want a foreign policy based on respect, based on self-determination.
Much of the Middle East is a region of oil, unexpected governments, and economies, victims of the usury of the International Monetary Fund. In this sense, the campaign of public opinion mounted by the paladins of the Western culture cast doubts on the humanity of Muslims. Europe has a similar history, but as a result of numerous testimonies, it is impossible to deny that in the United States an ethnic cleansing campaign is underway, and they are not isolated cases anymore. America for the Americans, says the slogans of the Anglo-Saxon Empire. The darker your skin, the less welcome you are in this land. And when the doctrine of manifest destiny inserted its requirements in the rhetoric of the day, the result became hatred, exclusion, and violence. But there is yet another America, the damned half, irreconcilable with the mentality of those who insist on racism. It's an America for all, for Christians, for Muslims, for Jews, Gentiles, and atheists. By constitutional mandate, whoever is born here is American and enjoys all rights and privileges. It is here where work, dreams, and efforts are put before creeds, colors, and political orientations. America is a land wherein a rebellious future grows that does not honor the obligations of a third party.
In the limelight.
For years and years, what came to be known as America's so-called war on terror, and later just its forever wars, enjoyed remarkable bipartisan support in Congress, not to say the country at large, says Andrea Mazzarino, writer, in an article published under the heading, Who authorizes America's wars, and why do they never end? Stay tuned for more. For years and years, what came to be known as America's so-called war on terror, and later just its forever wars, enjoyed remarkable bipartisan support in Congress, not to say the country at large. Over nearly two decades, four presidents from both parties haven't hesitated to exercise their power to involve military in all sorts of ways in at least 85 countries around the world in the name of defeating terrorism or violent extremism. Such interventions have included airstrikes against armed groups in 7 countries, direct combat against such groups in 12 countries, military exercises in 41 countries, and training or assistance to local military, police, or border patrol units in 79 countries. And that's not even to mention the staggering number of U.S. military bases around the world where counterterrorism operations can be conducted, the massive arms sales to foreign regimes, or all the additional deployments of this country's special operations forces. Providing the thinnest of legal foundations for all of these have been two ancient acts of Congress. The first was the authorization for the use of military force, AUMF, that allowed the president to act against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001, or harbored such organizations or persons. It led, of course, to the disastrous war in Afghanistan. Thinking back to when America's forever wars first began, it's hard to imagine how U.S. could still be fighting in Iraq and Syria under the same loose justification of a war on terror. Almost two decades later, or that the 2001 AUMF, untouched by Congress, still stands, providing the fourth president since the so-called war on terror began with an excuse for actions of all sorts. An unnamed senior administration official explained, "We have a responsibility to demonstrate that attacking Americans carries consequences, and that is true whether or not those attacks inflict casualties." He did not, however, explain what those American troops were doing in the first place at bases in Iraq and Syria. Note that such an act was taken on presidential authority alone, with Congress thoroughly sidelined, as it has been since it passed those AUMFs so long ago. To be sure, some Americans still argue that such preemptive attacks and really any military build-ups whatsoever are precisely what keep Americans safe. How many people died in those attacks? Whose lives in those target areas were destroyed by uncertainty, fear, and the prospect of long-term anxiety? It's also estimated that more than 801,000 people died in fighting among U.S. allied and opposing troops and police forces. And that doesn't include indirect deaths due to wrecked healthcare system, malnutrition, the uprooting of populations, and the violence that continues to plague traumatized families in those war zones and at home in the U.S. According to a stunning new report by Boston University's Ben Sheet, the big killer of Americans engaged in the war on terror has not in fact been combat but suicide, which has so far claimed the lives of 30,177 veterans and active service members. Suicide rates among post-9/11 war veterans were higher than for any cohort of veterans since before the Second World War. Among those aged 18 to 35, the oldest of whom weren't even of voting age when he first started those never-ending wars, and the youngest of whom weren't yet born, the rate has increased by whopping 76% since 2005. And if you think that those most injured from their service are the ones coming home after Iraq and Afghanistan, consider this. Over the past two decades, suicide rates have increased most sharply among those who have never even been deployed to a combat zone or have been deployed just one. A
It is hard to say why even those who don't fight are killing themselves so far from America's distant battlefields. As Sui points out, about 42% of Americans are now either unaware of the fact that their country is still fighting wars in the greater West Asia, North Africa region, or think that the so-called war on terror is over. Consider that for a moment. What does it mean to be fighting wars for a country in which a near majority of the population is unaware that you are even doing so? The burdens of America's forever wars are still shared by Americans in concrete ways. More frequent and longer deployments with shorter breaks. More abusive and all-encompassing command structures and very little clear sense of what it is this country could possibly be fighting for anymore or what the endgame might be. If strikes like the ones President Biden authorized last month reflect anything, it's that there are few ways, certainly not Congress, of reining in U.S. Commander-in-Chief from sending Americans to harm and be harmed.